So let's begin at Harvard for a summary of where we are with climate and with the huge blows in funding announced by the new administration in Washington, D.C. and Mar-a-Lago. Here is the renowned Naomi Oreskes, author of Merchants of Doubt, the definitive analysis of climate denials. She's now professor of the history and philosophy of science at Harvard, and just to remind, was once actually working as a geologist for Western Mining back in 1984 in South Australia. Given the present circumstances in the United States, especially concerning climate policy and so on, what are your reactions at the moment?
Well, I think it's a tricky moment because every day is different. Every day brings some new either outrage or encouragement from the courts who are saying, no, you actually can't do this. And I think we know that this is deliberate on their part. They're doing what people call flooding the zone. So many things, so many outrages all at once that people get confused, people get knocked on their back foot. And we know that that's deliberate. So I think it is important not to panic, not to overreact, and to try to stay calm and stay focused and really figure out what is going on here. And I think for me, given the work I've done, it's very clear that the vast majority of these actions are aimed at shrinking the federal government in order to diminish regulation of the marketplace and also to diminish science, because science provides the evidence that justifies many of these regulations that Elon Musk and his cronies don't like.
Of course, the problem with what you're doing with science, and some of it is going on in Europe and indeed to some extent in Australia because of money problems and so on, but stop, start. You can't do that with research without crippling it.
Well, that's right. And that was an argument I made during the COVID pandemic, that a lot of people in the business community would like to think, well, if you need it, then you'll just get it when you need it, sort of like just-in-time inventory. But science doesn't work that way. You can't just suddenly do science without a scientific infrastructure, without laboratories, without a trained workforce, without technicians. So if you dismantle a scientific workforce, it could take years to decades to rebuild.
What about the question of Paris and the international cooperation that is essential if the world is going to do its bit, nation by nation, to reduce our problem?
Well, Paris is tricky. I think in the worlds I move in of climate scientists and climate activists, the Trump administration threat to withdraw from Paris again is viewed as an outrage. I have a slightly different view, which is that I personally think that the whole COP process has been compromised and has fundamentally failed.
COP, in other words?
The committee of parties that are the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So most people aren't aware of this, but the United States and 193 other countries around the globe are signatories to an international treaty, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was signed in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. And that treaty commits us to acting to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. That's international law. But the question that was left after Rio was, okay, well, how do you do that? And like a lot of international treaties, the initial treaty lays out the goal, but doesn't say how it should be done. That was left to this process known as the COP process. So we've now had 30 meetings of COP. And I think that if you are objective about it and you see that a group of people have tried 30 times to do something and not succeeded, that it would be rational to say, well, maybe this process isn't working and maybe we need to do something else. But climate scientists and climate activists have been very reluctant to say that because they don't want to criticize what would seem to be the one process we have for international cooperation. But I do actually think there's possibly an opportunity here. It's tricky. It's a dangerous opportunity. But to say, well, okay, I mean, Donald Trump's motivations are dreadful. We know that. But given that the COP process, frankly, has failed, maybe it is time for us to rethink, could we do this in a different way that would be more effective?
One thing that's happened in lots of countries, especially Australia, is an attack from, as you put it, right-wing conservative parties and so on, to accept that there is a problem with climate. It's no longer a hoax, but that the means of applying the reduction of emissions, in other words, the alternative technologies, are being handled in a way that is criticisable. So you're attacking the means of change rather than the actual major concept. Are you finding that as well?
Well, one of the things we've seen in this space is that climate change deniers are clever and versatile. So we've seen over the past 20 years at different moments, depending upon how the political winds are shifting, they may change what their argument is. But fundamentally, it's always the same. Vested interests who profit off the existing, what I like to call the carbon combustion complex, because it's not just the oil and gas companies, it's also the people who profit from cheap fossil fuels. They do not want to change. And so they will make whatever argument they think will be effective. So it could be attacking the science. It could be attacking the integrity of scientists. It could be attacking the feasibility of a transition to renewable energy. It could be the cost of the transition. And each time they lose one argument, for example, we now know that in most countries in the world, renewable energy is actually cheaper than fossil fuels. And that's not including the so-called external costs, just what it costs to build a gas-fired power plant versus wind power or solar, what it costs to generate electricity. It's cheaper. Solar and wind are cheaper. They're better by any objective financial standard. So since you can't win on price, they have to make up some other story. Oh, well, it's not feasible. Wind power kills birds. Solar power kills lizards, you know, and they'll come up with whatever thing they think could work. And so here in the United States, we've been facing a disinformation campaign claiming that wind energy kills whales. There is no scientific evidence to support that. We have a lot of evidence about all kinds of bad things that have been done to whales, mostly hunting by human beings, some evidence of damage from sound pollution in the oceans, but no evidence to say that wind power is bad for whales. But there's been this massive campaign here in the northeast of the United States to try to undermine offshore wind, which is safe and cost effective, by claiming that it hurts whales and therefore getting liberals and environmentalists to oppose offshore wind.
Of course, your very, very well-known book, Merchants of Doubt, is explained, I think, by you as what they've done. And your new book on myths is why they did it. Is that more or less right?
Bingo. Yeah, that's why I love talking to you, Robin. Always great to talk to a journalist who gets it.
So what are the myths?
Well, the big myth is the myth of the free market, the myth of the magic of the marketplace, this idea that free markets are efficient, that governments are inefficient, and so the best solution to pretty much any problem is just to let the market do its magic. We know that's false. In the book, we talk about some of the evidence for how and why it's false. And so then the question is, well, why would anyone believe it? And so one of the things we show in this new book, the main thing we show, is a 100-year propaganda campaign designed to persuade us that it's true. And so by the time you read the book, you think, well, okay, it's kind of not our fault. You know, we've been bombarded with this message about the greatness of markets. So yeah, it's not surprising a lot of us think it's true.
Are you suggesting that the sensible thing might be to have both working together in a good, efficient combination?
What a shocking thought, you know. I mean, the older I get, the more I realize in life that the answer to most things is either D, all of the above, or both and, right? That I think, and Eric Conway and I make this argument in the book, that history clearly shows markets are good for a lot of things. They can be efficient. They can be good at creating consumer choice. And they are good at amalgamating information, which is one thing that the original neoliberal economists emphasized. And they're right about that. If you run a business, information from the marketplace will tell you a lot about what your consumer wants, how much they're willing to pay for it, how far they're willing to go. But they're also really bad at certain things. And the thing we know they're super bad at is dealing with what economists call the external costs, the costs of doing business that you don't pay. So if I own a factory and I dump pollution in the river behind my factory, or I emit carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, I don't pay any cost for that unless the government stops me. And so here in the United States, one of the interesting asymmetries about our laws is that it is illegal to dump garbage, toxic waste in a river, but it's not illegal to dump it in the atmosphere. And so part of the argument about climate change is that we need to fix that asymmetry, that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, just like toxic waste that you could dump in a river. And just like we don't let people dump toxic chemicals into rivers, lakes, and the ocean anymore, although we used to, but we don't anymore, we need to stop letting people dump toxic CO2 into the atmosphere.
And what's been the reaction so far to your book on myths?
Well, it's been very interesting. I feel that this is a book that people who get it, get it. And I've had so many emails from people, thanking me profusely for writing this book, saying, oh my God, this is a book that needed to be written. And then there's the people who have bought into the myth who, not surprisingly, aren't so happy about being challenged. So, you know, we had a kind of dismissive review in the New York Times and a kind of dismissive review in the Washington Post. I think it's good they did review the book. It shows they kind of admit that it's an important question. But I think there are a lot of mainstream people who have so bought into this idea of the efficiency of markets that it's really hard for them to say, oh, yeah, maybe we way overdid this, and maybe we did buy a line that wasn't in fact true.
Do you remember, I hate to, in Cambridge, Harvard University is in Cambridge, but in a place called Oxford, in a college which I have a number of associations, there was an economist called Adam Smith who rather explained some of this way back.
Yes. Well, an important part of the book, when you're writing a book, you try to make the book kind of as balanced as possible and not spend too much time in any one piece of it. But as the dust settles, the part of the book I'm most proud of is our conversation about Adam Smith. And actually, Eric and I are thinking about maybe a follow-up short book just about Adam Smith. Because of all the dreadful things that the people we've written about did, I think one of the most egregious is the misrepresentation of Adam
Smith. Well, he, of course, helped invent capitalism 200, 300 years ago.
Correct. So many people will say he's the father of modern capitalism and that he was the first person to really put forward this idea that you could trust markets to sort things out. And of course, it's from Smith we get the notion of the so-called invisible hand. Although, as many scholars have pointed out, it's not actually a big idea in The Wealth of Nations. I mean, he mentions it, but it's been made into a much bigger thing by subsequent commentators. But if you didn't know better, or if you just read The Wall Street Journal, or if you read a lot of economic textbooks in the United States, you would think that Adam Smith believed that you could just leave everything to the marketplace. That is 100% not true. So in the book, we have a discussion of this, and we point out that Adam Smith believed in taxation. He believed in progressive taxation, in which the rich pay more than the poor. He believed in minimum wages for workers. He believed in unionization. He believed in regulation of banks. You would never know this from the way most people talk about Adam Smith. So why is this? Why don't we know that about Adam Smith? And particularly, I mean, he's incredibly sympathetic to workers. Well, we argue in the book part of the reason we don't know this is because of the way Adam Smith was represented by the Chicago School of Economics, who in the mid-20th century became the dominant voice of economics in the United States and through that around the globe. George Stigler, who was a very important professor at Chicago, published an edited version of The Wealth of Nations that was designed for teaching, in which he removed all of the places in The Wealth of Nations where Smith talks about the need for regulation, taxation, protection of workers, and including a very extensive discussion in The Wealth of Nations about why it is essential, not just desirable, but essential in a capitalist economy to regulate banks. And this has been completely expunged. And so in the book, we put it back in and we call attention to this and we say people have misrepresented Adam Smith. And if you actually take seriously the real Adam Smith, what you see is essentially the argument we're making today. I mean, I actually want to call myself a Smithian now because this is our argument. It's a both-and argument. Yes, markets can be very good for some things. Yes, you definitely need banks and you absolutely need the government to regulate banks because left to their own devices, the self-interest of bankers will cause them to do things that are good for them but bad for the economy as a whole. And Adam Smith says that.
And Adam Smith says that.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Pleasure talking to you.
Naomi Oreskes, Professor of History and Philosophy of Science at Harvard, and she will be in Adelaide at the Hawke Centre at the University of South Australia on March the 11th in conversation with former South Australian Premier Mike Rann, talking about the big myth –